You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
I want to be the title sponsor. What's it going to cost?
I think around 10 million.
Yeah, I that's a bit out of my budget.
I have the impression that we are in the place where we have to be now.
Greg had a really bad back all last week, so we caught up on your podcast with me giving him a back massage and him listening to you guys.
That's a wonderful image.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney. There's no Richard or Daniel this week, so we thought we'd play an interview with Sean Kelly, the Irish cyclist who topped the world rankings for much of the 1980s. These days, Sean works as a co-commentator on the Grand Tours and major classics for Eurosport, and he owns the Anpost Chain Reaction team, which has developed a number of riders who've made the step up to the World Tour level. Kelly himself turned professional for the Flandria team in 1977, and I suppose Flandria was the Etics Quickstep of its day, run by one of the sport's legendary managers, Jean de Gribaldi, and featuring many of the top riders of the day, including Belgium's Freddy Martins. At the start of his career, Kelly forged a reputation as a fearsome sprinter. He won a stage of his very first Tour de France in 1978, and then moved away from de Gribaldi's team for 3 years. And it wasn't until 1982, when the pair were reunited, that Kelly's career really took off. It was de Gribaldi who convinced him that he could win races like Paris-Nice, and in 1982 he won the first of 7 in a row, a record that stands today. De Gribaldi then convinced Kelly he could be winning classics, and in 1983 he won his first monument, the Tour of Lombardy, and that ushered in the peak years of Kelly's career. In 1984 he won Milan-San Remo and Paris-Roubaix in the same spring, a feat not repeated until John Degenkolb did it this year. And finally, after winning the first of 4 green jerseys at the Tour de France in 1982, Kelly began to target high overall finishes in the Grand Tour. He managed 4th in the Tour in 1985, and he won the Vuelta in 1988. Kelly is considered one of the sport's greats, as much for his consistency as his versatility. Was he a sprinter who could climb, or just a true all-rounder? It's true that he could win classics and stage races and contend for the Grand Tours, and there's not really many riders who fit that profile today. In this conversation, we go back to the beginning of Kelly's career to ask him about his early days. But before we hear from Sean, we've got an offer for friends of the podcast and anyone else who wants to sign up to receive our weekly email bulletin. We're offering a copy of Sean Kelly's autobiography, Hunger, which I just happened to publish, in paperback for a fiver. That's down from £9.99. There'll be a special link for this offer in next week's newsletter, so sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. The sign-up box should appear automatically after a few seconds. If it doesn't, clear your browser's cache and it will pop up. Fill in the details and then you'll receive information about the podcast every week. Over to Sean. I started up by asking him how he got into cycling back in rural Ireland in the early 70s.
I discovered the bike before the 70s because I had to ride bike to get to school. From the moment I was able to ride a bike and stay upright, I had to ride to national school, which was 2.5 mile to and 2.5 mile from every day. And then, of course, the cycling club in Carrick. There were always a cycling club there for many years, going back much further back than the 70s. But they had a big split up. The committee had a big row, so they formed another club, as happens all over Ireland in small towns, you know, many times. Well, one was called Carrick Wheelers, and the other one was called Carrick Wheelers Road Club. That was the difference. So, yes, they weren't a big difference in name. But that was the way they made the distinction. Just one was a road club and one was just Carrick Wheelers. There was always a big rivalry there from the time they started in the 70s with the second club. And that helped the cycling in the town, because when you have another club, there's always big rivalry, as it is in other sports as well.
And of course, a lot of boys want to do what their elder brothers do. In fact, it was Sean's older brother, Joe, who got into cycling first.
Well, he was already in with probably 3-4 months at least. I wasn't really getting involved because he was a secondary school, and he was doing with his mates from the class that he was in. I wasn't really getting involved because he was in there. It was just when the members starting the new club, they came to the school, and with a number of classmates, we decided to go along on the Sunday afternoon for the first race.
Riding back and forwards to school was one thing, but Sean's competitive instinct meant he knew he had to race. And so one day he lined up for the weekly handicap race in Carrick, and they set him off in the first group. He never looked back. Well, he did, but you know what I mean.
First race I took part in, there's a little bit of uncertainty, first of all. Some people said it was a weekday in the evening. Other people say it was a Sunday afternoon. I just cannot remember, you know, which it was. Was it during the week or on a Sunday? But I went along, and of course, cycling to school, that was a help to me because I had probably a good base of fitness. When you arrive on, you know, your first race, it's a handicap base, of course, and I was giving a couple of minutes, and off I went with, I think there was, you know, maybe a couple of others with me, but I left them for dead pretty quickly, and on I went and won it on my own.
Racing on the road, knowing that the older, more experienced boys were behind him, trying to catch him, must have been exhilarating. But what did it feel like, that first experience of racing a bike?
Well, of course, when you go on your first race, you know, you're very nervous, and when you go out and back, of course, on the way out I left the others and I was on my own at the turn, and then on the way back I could see the others going out. And yeah, you know nothing about bike racing. You see the other ones, they've got racing bikes and, you know, they've been doing a number of races, so you're shit scared with fear. Yeah, I think when I see the other guys the way out, it made me go faster again because I was afraid, are they going to catch me? And I just went from A to B just as fast as I could go, and I managed to hold off and won quite comfortably. I think I finished with a minute and a half, and probably at the start maybe giving 3 minutes or 4 minutes.
This was 1970s Ireland, very much a cycling backwater in those days. Yes, there was a thriving amateur scene. Yes, they'd had Shay Elliott a number of years before, but cycling was not one of the major sports in Ireland. A copy of Cycling magazine sometimes took a couple of weeks to make it across the Irish Sea to Carrick, and then another week doing the rounds among the club members before Sean would even get a look. By then the news was out of date, but besides, there was nothing like the coverage of the professional races, even the Tour de France, that there is today. So when he was invited to join a group of Irish riders on a trip to Devon to take part in some races and see the Tour de France with his very own eyes, it was a real eye-opening experience. This, of course, was when the Tour made a day trip to Plymouth in 1974.
Certainly in the 70s, people knew very little about it. Where, if you look at it today, everybody can tell you, you know, how to ride the Tour of Italy and the Tour of France, even, you know, the slowest tourist you can meet on a Sunday morning. If you ask them about bike material, bike components, they can give you the full story. When I look back at that, and I say to myself, you know, I was greener than the grass in Ireland at that time, but that was, you know, the same for everybody. So yeah, I started learning slowly about, you know, the events, and went to Plymouth to see the Tour of France. There were some races for I think it was for juniors at that time, and I went there with a couple of Irish riders, Alan McCormick and John Short, and a number of other riders who were, you know, the best juniors in Ireland at that time. And then we see the Tour of France, and of course when you see the Tour of France, even back in those days, it was an eye-opener for me, and I suppose it just made my dreams get bigger.
In his book, Sean talks about seeing the Tour's publicity caravan whiz past. One of the reasons the race headed to Devon was to improve trade links between southern England and Brittany, and it was partly funded by Breton farmers. One of the vehicles in the publicity caravan was throwing out fruit and vegetables, and one of Sean's mates picked up an artichoke. Having never seen one before, he took a bite out of it as if it was an apple. Seeing the Tour was one thing, but there was never a eureka moment for Sean. He didn't stand by the roadside and think, one day I'm going to do that, because he didn't think it was an option at the time. It was not until he began to make progress with the Irish team, racing and winning stages of the Milk Race, or the Tour of Britain as he calls it, that his horizons began to expand.
When you know little, you dream little. And that was my... that's the way I was in the beginning, because, you know, it was a slow learning process, because, you know, you had only cycling magazines. And when I see the Tour of France, of course, you know, it did change things for me. But at that point I didn't really think about being professional, because it was something that was, you know, it was way off, it was over there in France and it was a long ways away. And then slowly I started to come through the ranks, and, you know, went to the Tour of Britain with the Irish team, first of all, you know, won the Junior Championship of Ireland and went away with the national junior team to some events. But when I went to the Tour of Britain, of course, and then won a stage in my first time taking part in the Tour of Britain, then I started, you know, to think maybe I could become a professional. And you know, it was slowly getting like a dream that could come true.
Had it not been for the actors Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, Kelly's professional career may have taken a completely different turn. In 1975, he was invited to take part in the Rapport Tour, a stage race in South Africa, to begin preparing for the following year's Olympics in Montreal. Remember, the Olympics were only for amateur cyclists in those days. Anyway, there was a catch. Because of apartheid, most nations imposed a ban on their sports people competing in South Africa. And so Sean and his teammates raced under false names for a British team. Unfortunately for them, Taylor and Burton were on their honeymoon nearby, and a journalist from the Daily Mail thought the presence of a British cycling team in the same town as the Hollywood stars had chosen for their honeymoon might make a story. The ensuing rumpus led to a ban from the Olympics for Kelly.
Went to South Africa the previous year. An invitation to go and ride the Rapport Tour, it was called. It was a week-long race, or a little over a week, and then we were given a holiday there for another week, all expenses paid. So, of course, yeah, for an 18-year-old, it was a trip of a lifetime. We were also competing there under false names. It was a British team. There was three Irish riders, two Scottish riders, and one of them was Pat McQuaid, ex-president of the UCI, which he talked very little about during his time in the UCI. So off we went, and we were competing under a British team under false names. My name was Alan Owen, and we believed that we'd be never found out. And unfortunately, Liz Taylor was on her second honeymoon with Burton, and the English tabloids were there, and they decided to make a story about it, and it all caught fire. And those photographs sent back to the British Cycling, and they said no, they are not British riders, they're Irish riders, and got thrown out of the Olympics. I was on the Irish Olympic shortlist, or panel, let's call it, and we were suspended from taking part in the Olympics. The race wasn't well known here at the time. There wasn't any reports about the race, so we felt that it was a good opportunity to ride a race at the end of season, first of all, because the winter was long. We would finish in maybe September at that time. We thought it would be a good way to prepare for the Olympics. Also, the trip, I think, was the big pull there. That was the thing that made us go there more.
As one door closed, another opened. Kelly went back to France to race as an amateur, and at the end of the year, a surprise visitor arrived at the family farm in Carrick. It was Jean de Gribaldi, who you could describe as the Matt Busby of cycling management. Having done his research, de Gribaldi flew in his private plane to Dublin and then took a taxi to the countryside to persuade Kelly to turn professional.
Quite a long story to that. First of all, of course, when I wasn't going to the Olympics in Montreal, I decided to go to France, and I went to a club in Metz Huapi, it was called. Because when I had been to the milk race, I had met with an English guy, Johnny Morris, who had a lot of contacts there, and he knew the president of the club, Aldo Bevignani. He said to me, if you want to come to France to race at any time, we'd always like to have you. You're always welcome to come to the club. Of course, when I wasn't going to the Olympics, I decided to go to France for that year, and packed my bags and off I went. Won quite a number of races, did very well, and won the Tour of Lombardy Amateur at the end of the year, and the decision was to go back to Metz for another year. But I did hear that there was a guy, Gribaldi, was interested in me signing me professional, but I never met any more of it when I was there. It was just other riders were talking to me about it. So it was the end of September, early October, I turned back to Ireland, and one day I was on, it was my brother's tractor actually. There was a taxi came to the house, and my mother sent it in the direction where I was on the coming back on the road, and I met this taxi, and Gribaldi was there, and there was a rider who I raced with in Metz, Noel Converset. Three guys got out of the taxi. The pilot, who was an English, he was a translator, he was able to speak English. And when I see Converset, of course, I had raced with him in Metz a number of times that year. He introduced to Gribaldi, and then, yes, of course, the penny dropped. It was the first time I had actually met de Gribaldi. I'd heard a bit about him. I got the story very quickly. He wanted to sign me for Flandre, and of course Converset was a big dreamer. He wanted to be professional, that was his dream, and he was also, yes, he was pushing on. He was probably late 20s at that time, so he said everything he was telling me was, it was sunshine all the way. And they came back to the house, and we had a discussion, and I said I think I'm a bit too young. I don't know if I'm good enough, if I have the experience. And I gave all the story, and they were saying, no, it's good. You can, make small races with de Gribaldi in France, because he had a lot of new professionals. But at the end, I said, look, I'll think about it, and away they went. And I said, give me a week and I will think about it. And of course, 5-6 days later, they were on the phone and Di Garibaldi wanted me to sign. And then I was talking with people in Ireland and trying to get some information, what should I do. And eventually I decided after, I think, 3 or 4 weeks to sign.
This was before the internet and mobile phones, of course.
Well, yeah, you imagine that, they just came over to Ireland on the hope that I would be there. I could have been, I could be anywhere. There was no contact made at all. Di Garibaldi had his own private plane. Yes, they came to Dublin. They got in a taxi and they drove down to Carrick-on-Shore, which is, 100 miles. Back in those days, it was a slow 100 mile, I can tell you. It would be, three and a half hour journey. And, out of the blue, they rock up at my home.
Kelly signed for Di Garibaldi and the Flandria team, and he learned quickly. His first year as a pro introduced him to the work of a domestique, mostly helping his team leader, Freddie Martins. But it wasn't long until he was winning races for himself, and at the Grand Prix Lugano in Switzerland, he outsprinted Merckx at the finish, the great Eddie Merckx, the five-time winner of the Tour. OK, so Merckx was nearing the end of his career, but still.
The first year professional, I started off in the south of France, which was the norm at that time. You'd have a lot of races down there. There was, so many races which have all disappeared now. And I went down there with all the younger guys, which was part of the Flandria France. It was that team, and we did Bessage and all of the other races. And I won my first race in Lugano, Grand Prix Lugano, which was after the Tour of Corsica, which was this at that time. And then I went on, and I beat Merckx in a sprint of a group of maybe 15 or 20 riders. I remember it was a very windy day, and he was riding pretty good, but a long ways off his best, of course, because it was, coming to the end of his career. And I just remember in the final 2 kilometres or so, his team was taking the front, and I just got on his wheel, and he went for this long, long sprint, and I just came over in the last 50 metres, 80 metres. And of course, when you come over Merckx in a sprint for a young guy from Ireland, a very timid guy, it was a little bit uncomfortable for me on the podium. Merckx was there, and he took it in his stride. And for me, it was just an amazing time to beat Merckx in a sprint. And, I can still remember that sprint pretty well to this day.
Those first races taught Kelly a lot about the professional peloton and how it worked.
It was very much respected, the big names and the big riders when you're in the peloton. When it gets to the end of a race, you don't really push them about much. And that was the understanding. That's totally gone out the door the past 15 plus years. And now the new guys coming on, they just care for nobody. And we've heard that, and I've heard that from a lot of riders over the past 15 to 20 years. My situation was, coming from Ireland, I was, a very quiet guy, talk very little, only answered when I was asked the question. And for me, to beat Merckx, it was a real special moment. And pat him on the back or shake hands, there was certainly no thought of that at all.
In 1978, Kelly rode his first Tour de France, and he won a stage at Poitiers, outsprinting a small group of riders who he'd got away with towards the end of the stage.
Well, I suppose in my career there was a lot of steps which were, you'd wonder, could you ever make those steps? And that was right in the beginning, first of all, when I started out racing, and then you had to go on, and even as an amateur, just to win stages in the Tour of Britain milk race, and then go on to be a professional, get a professional contract. And as you mentioned, the first race is winning against Merckx, and in my first year, winning some nice races, and going to the Tour of France was another big step in my career. And of course, yes, the Tour of France is always it's a major step. And for me, it was it was scary times, because the Tour of France, 3 weeks. And the way you prepare for the Tour of France, maybe not as well as the guys now in the most recent years, meaning 15, 20 years now, they're prepared much better. They have all of their own coaches. So, things have changed a lot. So many things have changed. And for me, going to the Tour of France for the first time, being Irish as well, I suppose, not competing in those races where you go over the big mountain passes in the Alps and the Pyrenees. For me, it was a big eye-opener.
That first tour was hard. There was a very long team time trial in the first week. 153 kilometres on rolling country in Normandy. 153 kilometres. It's unthinkable now for a team time trial, which tends to be around the 35 or 40 kilometre mark. But as Sean says, the riders of the 1950s and 60s thought that the riders of the late 70s were soft.
Back in those days, you didn't really think about it, because when you look at the Tour of France, there was 60 kilometres plus individual time trials. Team time trials, there was quite a few, and long ones as well, and they had been longer ones, and you think nothing about it. But as time go on, and now, you know, if you say that to some of the younger guys, professionals, you know, they'd say, is this guy, he's suffering from Alzheimer's, he doesn't know what he's talking about, because they just wouldn't believe that. And you know, but for me, it was just, you know, part of the part of being professional, part of riding the Tour of France. The big favourites for the tour, the big contenders for them, they just went out there and got on with the business. Where, you know, it's totally changed now, and you know, that's a thing of the past. But you know, you can go on about the past, and you go back, you know, you go back in the 50s and 60s, you know, the stage distances and the team time, or the individual time trials, you know, they were, you know, unbelievable distance, and how the guys managed to do that. And of course, for me, in the Flandre team, I suppose that was the thing I was most concerned about. The team I was with, you know, Martens, De Meyer, Pollentier, all of those riders, Agostinho, it was a big challenge, you know, to ride a tour, a stage of the Tour of France team time trial of that distance.
When the tour reached the big mountains, it was a real baptism of fire. There were only a few races, other than the Grand Tours, that visited these high mountain roads, and if a rider wasn't selected for those races, the Cols remained something of a mystery.
Of course, I was in the team as a helper. It was I was there to help Martens, because in the mountains I wasn't, you know, at that level to be able to do anything in the mountain stages of any importance. So on the flat stages, Martens, he was a sprinter. He was one of the, you know, the best sprinters of that time, and I was there to help him. And you know, there was orders there that look after Martens in any of the sprints. But there was an occasion into Poitiers where there was a little bit of, you know, undulating in the end, the last 30, 40 kilometres, 50 kilometres maybe, and there was a lot of attacks. So I just found myself in a breakaway with, I think, Knetemann was there, Joseph Breyer, Bitanger, Nielsen, the Swede, and I won in the sprint.
There certainly wasn't a trend of having a training camp in the mountains back then, so it might take a rider several years to become familiar with even the most famous mountains.
No, the only opportunity to do the big mountains in the Alps, for example, was in the Dauphiné. So if you were riding and you were selected for the Dauphiné, then you went over some of the climbs that you would be going over again in July in the Tour of France. But question of going on a training camp in the mountains, it didn't exist at that time. It just wasn't the done thing in the teams.
After 3 years, Kelly left Di Gribaldi's team and moved to Belgium, and this was a period where his career drifted a bit. He still won races and was forging a reputation as a handy sprinter, and he didn't appreciate it at the time, but he missed Di Gribaldi's discipline and guiding hand.
As a professional bike rider, you know, it's so easy to drift, just a little thing. You can lose so much, and that was something, you know, my first years with Di Gribaldi, he was there, he learned me a lot in my first years, but myself, I had learned everything. But I moved team, then I went to Splendor, and you know, the first year there, I realised that yes, I was leaving things slip, and it's very easy to leave things slip. You know, your training, how you do your training, you know, the quality of your training, all of that. And I think I realised that after a number of months of leaving Di Gribaldi, not only the training, but all around the training as well, your rest, your diet. Like, he was really strict on that, and he was always about. He was always looking over your shoulder at breakfast time, at evening meal, especially in the beginning of season, when you come back after, you know, a long period off in the winter time, which was a longer period than, you know, the riders have now, because now it's, you know, it's a tiny break for the riders because the program of races they've got. So yes, you know, he was a big part of my success in my first years, and I realised after leaving the team, you know, that how valuable he was to me. So I decided to go back to Gribaldi, and you know, I was with him for 10 years at least, and I think my results and my palmarès, there's a big part to it because of Di Gribaldi, because yeah. I came from a background where I knew very little about cycling, and I think he was somebody who was a long ways ahead of his time, and I realised that, and I think other people realised it as well, much later in years. Well, I think that's something that you need. You need somebody to keep you motivated, and especially, you know, at times maybe when your form is not good, times of the year when maybe the weather is not good. You know, there's a lot of little things that kind of affect on your training, first of all, and then that leads down to your performance at races. And the Garibaldi was very important, as I mentioned. And when I went to Belgium, and when it's actually happening, first of all, it's happening in training, but you don't really think about it in the training. It's when you go to the races, and then you start having problems getting results, and then you start, you know, asking the question, you know, why is this happening? How is it happening? And then you go and you look at your training, and you know, when you research into it, it's then you realise where it's going wrong. And you know, that's what I realised after probably, you know, 6 months after leaving the Garibaldi, in my fourth year certainly, when I went to Splendour, I started to realise that during that season.
The sprints in the 1970s and 80s were hectic and often rough. As Sean says in his book, a sprint finish was sometimes like the Wild West with the cowboys all out of control.
Well, yes, the sprints were pretty hectic because you could get away quite a lot. So there was a lot of, yes, jersey pulling. It's totally out of cycling now, it's extinct. Because of the cameras, the moment you start doing that, well, then you're going to be disqualified immediately. But back in the 70s and the early 80s, it was something that happened quite a lot. It wasn't something new, so it was something I had seen. So yes, I thought it sometimes being the norm. Well, of course, you cannot do it now. First of all, you know, with the cameras on the race, then with social media, all of that, you know, you're going to be everywhere, and you know, it's something that we don't see, and that's the reason, because you're not allowed to do it. But I think if you're allowed to do it, and it was happening a lot at that time, well, then yeah, it happens on occasions. But yeah, if you look at my career, you know, in the 80s, it happened 4 or 5 times. It's nothing.
One big rivalry Sean had was with the Belgian rider Eric van der Aarden, and it's fair to say the pair didn't always see eye to eye.
You know, we had a number of hairy or dangerous sprints in the Tour of France. I had one where we started pulling at each other, and it got disqualified. And then I think it was at Grand Prix of Formy, there was another one where we got into a bit of a punch up after the finish. But yeah, those things were. They were, you know, happening quite regularly back in the mid-80s.
That fight Kelly mentioned with van der Aarden, there was another showdown at an end of another race where the Belgian aimed a kick at Kelly's, what should we say, most delicate area. But because van der Aarden was wearing cycling shoes, his standing leg slipped from under him and he fell on his backside. Imagine that now if Mark Cavendish and Marcel Kittel squared up at the end of a race. Imagine the headlines that would be generated and the controversy. But it was a different era then.
On the Tour of France, that De Garibaldi was, you know, reminding me all the time that I could do a result in the Tour of France, but also in the races previous to that, because you just don't rock up at a Tour of France and start doing performances. You know, there's a build up to it in races like the Paris-Nice and the Tour of Switzerland, and you know, the shorter stage races, let's call them. And then in the Tour, of course, I took the yellow jersey. It was a pretty difficult stage, so I managed to get some bonuses in the end, and took the jersey by a very slim margin. Unfortunately, the next day was a big mountain stage. Was in difficulty pretty quickly. I think the weight of the yellow jersey was something that I didn't carry very well, and performed you know, in that stage much weaker than I had been performing in the past. Lost the jersey and lost a lot of time on that stage.
By 1983, Di Garibaldi was trying to convince Kelly he could aim for the podium at the Tour. He'd won the Tour of Switzerland just before the 1983 Tour de France, and in the absence of Bernardino, Kelly's name was on the long list of contenders. As the race approached the Pyrenees, he had an opportunity to get into the yellow jersey by the slimmest of margins. He had to make the calculations just right to take the jersey.
No, I think I knew that I was about to take it because I was, you know, making the calculation, and I knew that if I could get what the places in the finish would be very important. But if I could achieve that place in the sprint, well, then I would go into yellow. So I was pretty much working for it during that day, and as I said, yeah, when you get the jersey, you're always hoping that you can, you know, maybe hang on for a number of days. But for me, unfortunately, it wasn't the case.
That night, Kelly's friends Herman and Elise Nice, the Belgian couple who helped and supported him for so many years and even invited him to live at their home, sought divine intervention. Kelly was staying in Lourdes that night, the religious destination of pilgrimage at the gateway to the Pyrenees, and Herman took, was it the yellow jersey or the bouquet of flowers, I'm not sure which, to the grotto at Lourdes to get them blessed for good luck.
No, he didn't actually take the yellow jersey, he took the bouquet and he took them to the grotto in Lourdes. Hoping that would get me through for the rest of the tour, but unfortunately, as I've mentioned, the following stage, the first mountain, I was in difficulty pretty much immediately.
The next day in the mountains was hot, and Kelly always suffered in the heat, and it was on that day that his one and only yellow jersey slipped away.
Hot weather for me was always a difficult nut to crack. I always seemed to struggle when it was really warm, and on that day it was very warm conditions, something that I never really acclimatized to right through my career. I did get better, but there was occasions when it did really get warm. I think that day was exceptionally warm, so that was part of the reason that I underperformed.
So that first and only Tour de France yellow jersey Sean wore was stolen from his car in Paris at the end of the race.
I had the yellow jersey in my case, and after the final stage, I put my suitcase in the car because I was travelling back to Belgium on the Sunday evening, the Sunday night, and went back to the hotel. I think I went back to have something to eat, and when I arrived, the car had been broken into, and my suitcase had been stolen with the yellow jersey and with a lot of lots of green jerseys also. You know, the organisers did make me a presentation of another jersey, or gave me another jersey. It's not the one that I struggle to carry over the mountains. You know, it's always a dream to get the yellow jersey. I think I had the advantage; I was able to climb, you know, a bit better. So, and then in the sprints, I was able to take the bonification. So, you know, for those reasons, that I managed to get into the yellow jersey. And if it's only for one day, well, it's a dream that every bike rider has.
So that's Sean Kelly talking a little bit about some of the formative experiences in his cycling career. We'll no doubt catch up with Sean at some point, perhaps early next year, to talk about the classics and the Grand Tours and the races that forged his reputation. But if you'd like to read a bit more about his career in his own words, then his autobiography Hunger is available as a paperback. And if you are a friend of the podcast and you signed up to receive our weekly newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com, you can get a nice discount on a copy of that book now, just in time for Christmas. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Cycling Podcast. A little bit different this week. We'll be back to normal, I think, next week. Daniel may well be returning from Berlin. Richard will be back from his adventures in northern Spain. So we'll see you then.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/TCP to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.